joining us as we participate in the Lord's Supper that don't have any kind, excuse me, of biblical background knowledge. So you talk about Abraham, and if you've been a Christian for a while, you say, well, everybody knows who Abraham is. But if you haven't been a Christian and you don't have any biblical knowledge, everything is brand new to you. And so you can't take a shortcut and say, well, you know, that was Abraham, because they don't know that. So we're going to take a real basic approach. So we're going to take a what seems to be a painfully slow approach, but it answers some questions that people have had about the Lord's Supper for a long time. So let's get started, and we start with sharing my screen. So when you think about the Lord's Supper, you have to talk about when it was begun by Jesus. The Lord's Supper had never been a part of anybody's worship or anybody's relationship with God until the last time that Jesus ate a Passover Seder. And that just means a Seder is the Passover meal where they ate the Passover lamb. So it has never existed until the last Passover Seder that Jesus ate with his disciples. And because it was embedded within the Passover, it's important that we think about some information concerning what the Passover was. And the Passover itself is embedded in this much larger feast that was celebrated by the Jews called the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And then because this was a part of Jewish religious practice based on Old Testament law, we need to understand the significance of the Sabbath in order to really understand the context of the Lord's Supper. And all of this, the Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and Sabbaths, those are all discussed in Exodus, the 12th chapter, beginning at verse 1. Now, the concept of Sabbath is much older than what we're reading today, but in the course of creating the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, Moses picks up the Sabbath, something that had already existed with the Jews, and he kind of imports that into the Feast of Unleavened Bread and the discussion of the Passover. So, first, let's talk a little bit about the history of the Israelites pre-Passover, before this all happened in the Old Testament. And we'll go back to when the Israelites began. And that was with Abraham. Remember, Abraham is told, get up, leave your father's country, and go to a place that I will show you. And he's given three great promises in Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3. Well, it's really one promise with three parts. First part of that promise that God made to Abraham was, I'll give you a land. Second part of that promise, I'll make you a great nation. You'll be like the stars of the heavens, you just almost unnumberable. And then the third part of that promise, I'll make you a blessing for all nations. Now, that part of the promise looks forward to Jesus, and Jesus being a part of Abraham's lineage. And of course, Jesus is the blessing for all nations, all men and women everywhere who have ever lived have any kind of relationship with God. It's based on Jesus. Now, Abraham is given a great promise, but he struggles to believe what God said, because when this promise is given to Abraham, he doesn't have any children. And God says, I'm going to make your descendants like the stars of the heavens. And Abraham doesn't have any children at all. So Abraham, in his struggle to believe God, says, well, I can't have a child with my wife, Sarah. She's barren. So I will have a child with my slave. And Ishmael is born. And God says, no, that's Abraham. That's not what I was talking about. You're going to have your son. And eventually that did happen. And his name was Isaac. So Abraham has two sons in Isaac. Ishmael is not the child of the promise, and that's going back to Genesis 12. Remember that big promise that God gave to Abraham? That promise is going to be fulfilled through Isaac, and so the promise is renewed to Isaac. And then Isaac struggles, because Isaac has two boys, Esau and Jacob. Esau he's a rugged individual. He doesn't really respect the things of God. And he can't get along with his brother. And his brother cheats him out of his birthday. Esau's a firstborn. And that meant that he was supposed to get the lion's share of the inheritance, but he doesn't value that. Jacob cheats him out of it for a pot of soup. And so Jacob is the one. He's still the child of the promise. And Jacob struggles. Jacob has 12 sons. One of them is named Joseph. And the boys, 11 of the boys, can't stand their brother Joseph. So they decide that they're going to kill him. And one of the brothers prevails and says, well, let's not kill him. Let's sell him into slavery. So they do. Anyway, Jacob, after some ups and downs, winds up down in Egypt. He starts as a slave. He rises to a position of prominence in Potiphar's house. Potiphar's wife accuses him of rape. Joseph goes back to being the lowest of the low, and now he's in prison. The Pharaoh has a dream. Joseph interprets the dream. Joseph gets promoted to be the second in charge in all of Egypt. Then his own family, those 11 brothers that sold him into slavery, are reduced to poverty. They're reduced to a position of not having enough to eat. And because Joseph has wisely stored grain in Egypt, when this great worldwide famine hits, Joseph's brothers are sent by Jacob, whose name has been changed to Israel, down to Egypt to buy food. Well, long story short, They buy the food. The rest of the family moves down to Egypt. Joseph is in a position where he can take care of them. They're given a place to live. They become a large part of the kingdom of Egypt, 600,000 at least men, and that doesn't even include the women and children. And as they grow in number, Pharaoh gets worried about it. He doesn't really remember what Joseph has done to preserve Israel, so he enslaves all of these people. He's worried that they're going to grow powerful enough to take over his kingdom, so he enslaves them. They spend decades in slavery. And then along comes Moses. And God says through Moses to Pharaoh, let my people go. Now, you can imagine Pharaoh's reaction to that. Who on earth do you think you are telling me to let your people go? I am the crowned king and the equivalent of a god in the most important nation in history, and you're telling me to let these people go. So Pharaoh says no. Moses says, God's going to bring a plague. You will let his people go. He brings the first plague. Moses or Pharaoh says, no, I'm not going to let the people go. Moses says, another plague. Moses or Pharaoh says, no, another plague. This happens 9 times. Pharaoh is not going to let the people go. Finally, God gives some instructions to Moses. And Moses has to prepare the children of Israel to leave Egypt, because he's going to bring this last plague, this 10th plague, and Pharaoh will decide to let the people go. So, this is in the context of Moses preparing the children of Israel who are in slavery in Egypt to leave Egypt, because he knows when this plague happens, Pharaoh is going to let you go. So this is the instruction. This is what Exodus 12 is talking about. This is the instruction that Moses gives to the children of Israel while they're in bondage in Egypt, because God's going to bring this plague and Pharaoh is going to let the people go. So the Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, this is God giving Moses instruction. This month shall be the beginning of months for you. In other words, everything after this is going to revolve around this time. So he says, this month is the beginning of months. And it, by the way, it was the month of Nisan, N-I-S-A-N. And I'll probably slip and call that Nissan, because it when you see that word, it just makes you think of the car company. It's not Nissan, it's Nisan. It became the first month of the Jewish year. Everything in Judaism revolves around this month. He says, this month is the beginning of months for you. It is to be the first month of the year for you. Speak to all the children of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, they are each one to take a lamb for themselves according to their father's household, a lamb for each household. Now, If the household is too small for a lamb, then he and his neighbor nearest to his house are to take one according to the number of persons in them in proportion to what each one should eat. You're to divide the lamb. And so you had to have a big enough household to carry out some of the later instructions concerning this. But there's a couple of things to notice about this. This was a corporate activity that they were engaged in. It belonged to the household. It wasn't a commandment to individuals. This was something that a household did. And we'll see later why that is as we continue reading. This lamb that you take is to be an unblemished male, a year old. You can take it from the sheep or the goats. Doesn't matter. It's an unblemished male. So you couldn't go out to your flock and find a lamb that you knew just wasn't going to make it. It's on its last legs and use that for your Passover lamb. Nope, had to be one of the best. You'll keep it until the 14th day of the same month. So you brought this lamb into your house to be with your family. And the way that the Israelites lived back then was you generally kept your animals on the first floor of your house, and then your family lived above the animals that you had. So you take this animal in, and it becomes almost like a part of your family. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel is to slaughter it at twilight. 14th day of the month of Nisan, every one of the households or combined households that had taken one lamb together would slaughter their lamb at twilight. They shall take some of the blood, put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses in which they eat it. The doorposts are the side jams, and the lintel is the top of the door. So you take some hyssop and you dip it in. Hyssop was just a plant. You dip it in the blood. You smear it on the door jam in your house where you're going to eat this. Now, the reason that you do this will be revealed in just a minute. But that night, the 14th of Nisan, you eat the flesh of that lamb. And it had to be prepared in a special way. It had to be roasted with fire. And you would eat it with unleavened bread and some bitter herbs. Don't eat any of it raw or boiled at all with water, but rather roasted with fire, both its head and its legs, along with its entrails. You shall not leave any of it over until the morning, but whatever is left until the morning, you shall completely burn it with fire. So you can see the reason for having a family group of 10 so that you could eat the whole lamb. You wouldn't be able to eat it if it was just an individual. Now, this is the way that you eat it. Remember, this is something that they're doing in preparation to be released from Egyptian captivity. You'll eat it this way, with your garment belted around your waist, your sandals on your feet, your staff in your hand. You shall eat it in a hurry. The Lord's Passover. I'm going through the land of Egypt on that night. I will fatally strike all the firstborn of the land of Egypt. That's that 10th plague, that last awful plague that convinced Pharaoh that when God said, let my people go, he needed to listen. I'm going to strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the human firstborn to the animals. Against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. Now, remember this blood that they put on the door jamb around their in the houses where they live? This blood is a sign on the house where you live. When I see the blood, I will pass over you. No plague will come upon you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. So you can see why it's called a Passover. It was so that God would see the blood and this awful plague would not happen to the Israelites. Happened everywhere else. Pharaoh lost his firstborn. Every firstborn male in Egypt died that night. Not just humans, but animals as well. So that's the origin of the Passover. And it has been celebrated throughout history. Now, there were times when the Israelites forgot about this and they didn't really pay much attention to celebrating the Passover. But they always had this in the back of their mind. Remember, there were times and the law of God gets kind of disregarded and people don't do this anymore. And then they would find the law and they'd read the law and they'd say, we need to do this. This is important. And they would go back and they would do it again. Now, today, they can't do this. And we'll talk about why they can't do this in a little bit later. But this has always been important to the Jews. So any questions about what the Passover was? Some of these important thoughts about the Passover. I know that for many of you, that's absolutely review. And I know that we went through hundreds of years of history in just a few minutes, but it's just important to understand this. Okay. Now, this Passover feast is embedded within a 7-day feast. And that feast, the feast around the Passover in for the Jews is called the Feast of Unleavened Bread. After Moses has described the Passover, he then describes this Feast of Unleavened Bread. This is Exodus 12, beginning at verse 14. This day shall be a memorial to you. You can imagine, you've been in bondage for decades. Today you're going to be let go. This is going to be a memorial to you. You'll celebrate it as a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. You're to celebrate it as a permanent ordinance. They were to do this every year. For 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day, you remove dough with yeast from your houses. Whoever eats anything with yeast from the first day to the seventh day, that person will be cut off from Israel. So it's a 7-day feast, no leavening in your house. That's the stuff that makes bread rise. On the first day, That would be the 15th of Nisan. You shall have a holy assembly. 15th of Nisan. And you'll have another holy assembly on the seventh day. No work at all shall be done in them. That's kind of the definition of this holy assembly, this what makes this day holy. No work shall be done in them, except for what may be eaten by every person, that alone may be prepared by you. So you can still cook your meal. You shall also keep this feast of unleavened bread, for on this very day I brought your multitudes out of the land of Egypt. Therefore, you shall keep this day throughout your generations as a permanent ordinance. So they have these two things that God gives them to help them remember that they were taken out of Egypt. They were released from captivity or from bondage, and it was by the hand of God. Now, when you read Exodus, the 12th chapter, that's really pretty straightforward. It's really pretty simple. After they come to the land of Canaan, they're released, and then they wander in the wilderness for 40 years because God said, I told you I was going to give you this land. They sent some spies into the land. And the spies came back and said, we can't take that. There are giants in the land. God says, if you don't listen to me, you're just going to wander around out here in the wilderness. So they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. They get ready to go into the land. And Moses repeats all of this. And so we'll look back at Moses reiterating this. And he adds some things to it. And they make the things that he adds makes a lot of sense. But Jews have a habit of taking, and it's not just Jews, it's all of us. They have a habit of taking things that are really very simple and making a lot of formula things around this. And then they forget that the thing that they were doing is really relatively simple, and they focus on the traditions that they come up with. For instance, remember back here when Moses said, on the first day, you'll remove all the dough from your houses that has yeast in it? Well, they came up with a formula for doing that on the first day. And they said this has to be done with a broom that's made in a certain way because you could reach under the furniture in your house and you could sweep all the floors, and this broom would get all of the yeast and it would remove all of the yeast from your house. Well, they wanted to be sure that they did that. So they developed this tradition, this ritual, where on the first day, when they're removing all the dough from their houses, they would hide some little pieces of dough that had yeast in them. And they'd go through and they'd sweep. And whoever found that one, that hidden one, would get a prize. Well, I mean, I understand what they're doing. They're trying to say, look, you need to sweep everywhere, so that household is going to hide some dough in a place where you're not likely to sweep. But if you do and you find that one, then you get a prize. And if nobody finds it, we know that you haven't swept the house. So they would hide a piece of yeast or dough that had yeast in it. And you had to find that one. So remember, God didn't say anything about doing that. He just said, get all of the yeast out of your house. So they came up with this way to make sure that they were doing that. And then eventually the focus changed from getting rid of all the yeast and remembering what God did to playing this game to see who was going to get that hidden piece of dough that had yeast in it. Well, by the time that you come to Jesus observing this feast with his disciples, the last one that he observed with them before his death, there were all kinds of rituals that the Jews had built around what should have been a really very simple thing. They said, you can't, for instance, you can't have any dough in your house that has taken more than 14 minutes to be baked. And that's because yeast just naturally floats around in the air. And if you had dough that you had kneaded and you set it aside and you were going to bake it, you couldn't have it sitting there for more than 14 minutes. Yeast is what makes the dough rise. This is what today we call it proofing your dough, I guess. You let it rise. You don't have to put yeast in it. It will absorb yeast from the air. Now, we typically do add yeast to our dough, but that's why San Francisco sourdough tastes like no other sourdough anywhere on the face of the earth, because the yeast that's in San Francisco in the atmosphere gives that bread a particular flavor. So they said, you can't let dough sit for more than 14 minutes. In fact, the matzah crackers that they typically eat on that day, the 15th of Nisan, those matzah crackers are made in a machine, and those matzah crackers go from flour mixed with oil to matzah cracker. It's baked within 7 minutes. So there were all these things that happened. Now, last thing I want to talk about is the idea that this day was to be a Sabbath for you, or Shabbat. Sabbath is the Greek word. Shabbat is the Hebrew word. Same thing. And we typically think that Sabbath means Saturday. And it does. It's the seventh day. That's the day that God rested. We know that that comes from the Garden of Eden. This is something that began when God created the world. So Sabbath was the seventh day. It's the day that God rested. It's really interesting that the day that you ate the Passover is described as a Sabbath. It's a day when you don't do any work. And during that seven-day period that begins on the 15th of Nisan, there might be three Sabbaths. Because you might not be eating the Passover on Saturday, the seventh day. You're eating it on the 15th of Nisan. And we're familiar with what happens when a holiday falls on a prescribed day, like New Year's Day. That's always the 1st of January. Some years it's on Monday, some years it's on Tuesday, some years it's on Wednesday. And if you're an astronomer, you can figure all of that out. You can know whether what day of the week New Year's Day is going to fall on out 50 years into the future. But it rotates. And if we, in our culture, we use a Georgian calendar, which is based on a solar year. The Hebrews used a lunar calendar, which is based on the moon phases. And on top of all of that, you start counting days. When God rested, then the next day is the first day. Second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth. Then you rest. That's a Sabbath. Then first day. So then you have days of the week. So you might have three Sabbaths. If the 15th of Nisan fell on any other day in that particular year. Now, why is that such a problem? What makes that rotate throughout the year? Because God said, this is the day that this is this month. You're going to number everything from this month. This is the day that I'm going to lead you out of the land of Egypt. Well, it turns out that a lunar calendar should be based on the phases of the moon, and from one new moon to the next new moon is 29 days, 12 hours, and 4 minutes. Now, we don't have any calendars that have 29 days and then an extra 12 minutes and or 12 hours and 4 minutes. That's why the days of the week rotate. If you base it on the solar calendar, a solar year, that's 365 and a quarter days to go one time around the sun. And that's why we have leap years. Now, the Jews solved that problem. One year, the months had 29 days, but then you had 12 hours and 4 minutes left over. So the next month would have 30 days, and you'd be back on schedule. Then 29, then 30, then 29, then 30. And eventually, all those 4 hours that were left over get stacked up, and you have to do something. So the Jews, every so often, their year would have 13 months. They just added a month. And that month is called Adar. Comes right before Nisan, so that Nisan always falls at the right time of year. And we could read more about the feasts that they had, but one of the feasts that was associated with all of this was the first fruits. And that feast depended on when the barley was ripe. So if the barley was ripe, you had the Feast of First Fruits. It was always in the spring, but we know when all of these things happened. But a Sabbath was, it doesn't only mean Saturday. Now, 99% of the time when you read Sabbath in the Bible, you read Saturday. But not always. You might have a Shabbat that occurred on the 15th of Nisan when you couldn't do any work because you had to celebrate the Passover on the 15th of Nisan. That's when Jesus ate the Passover. Jesus is a Jew, and he ate the Passover on the 15th of Nisan. Otherwise, he'd have been violating the law. It wasn't Saturday. That year, it wasn't Saturday because 3 days after Jesus ate the supper, He was raised from the dead. And we know that that happened on Sunday. Questions? And I have to apologize. I had everything set up so that I could put my image on the screen just like we always do. And I could watch everything that was going on, and I could see everybody that was trying to make a comment. And my computer decided that it was not going to cooperate with me today, and I couldn't fix it. So I apologize for that, but at least you'll have all of these things saved, and you'll be able to watch them again. If you'd like a copy of the PowerPoints, then get in touch with me, and or get in touch with Jerry, and Jerry will have a copy of the PowerPoints. They'll be up on the website. We will get to the Lord's Supper, but you have to understand, this was the day that Jesus was celebrating it. This was the day that Jesus started the Lord's Supper. There's some marvelous correspondences between the events that were happening around Passover and Jesus dying on the cross. Okay. If there are no comments, no questions, we'll get back together again tomorrow night. We'll have prayers. If you have a request that we need to include in the prayer list, of course, get that to me and we'll include it in the prayer list for tomorrow night. Otherwise, we'll see everybody at 7 o'clock tomorrow night.